having two kids back to back at a really young age and deciding to not dichotomize my sexual self and my parenting self. Like, I made a conscious decision to not separate myself into different people.
That sounds hard, because I think a lot of us have a habit of doing that. We're talking now with Ariel Clark. We're at a photo shoot at the Center for Sex and Culture. This is a photo shoot for Fleur-de-Lis SF, San Francisco's sluttiest blogger, her Sexy Circus. It's coming up at Supper Club on September 20th. And it'll be quite a show. Jiz Lee is here dressed up as a lion, Vagina Jenkins, Lady Ripley. Nina Hartley is going to be doing a scene with Jiz Lee, which is so exciting. Maggie Mayhem and Ned are here. We have people dressing up in crazy costumes. Maggie's looking at me like it's a surprise. Shut up. And so I am shutting up.
This is sex. Everyone gets what they want. This is Sexploration.
Explore. Play.
This is Sexploration with Monica.
Sex is proof that God loves us and wants us to have fun.
Sexploration with Monica at sexplorationwithmonica.com.
Well, I'm talking about the Sexy Circus and all the funny things that you're going to be wearing, but it's a surprise. But let me tell you, it's going to be like, all at the same time. It's going to be really great. So the Sexy Circus, that's going to be on Fleur-de-Lis's website. I think is probably the best place to get all that information at fleurdelissf.com. And Ariel Clark has some gorgeous, sexy, very interesting ideas bouncing around in her head and some very interesting books that she's planning on writing that we're going to be talking about. But first, I wanted to talk about your work. It was your master's thesis for, I imagine, a human sexuality master's?
Correct, at San Francisco State. I just graduated from the Sexuality Studies program.
An excellent program. And it's about the intersection of identity and sexuality and polyamory, which is really, and race.
Right. It's my master's thesis was in ethnography. I spoke with five people of color who all identify as polyamorous. They all live in Oakland. And I was able to kind of follow them around for a summer and understand what they go through in their day-to-day lives as being parents, of being in multiracial relationships, of having family structures, and what community they found in the Bay Area, which is known for being such a very, you know, a very welcoming polyamorous environment.
But sometimes it's also a very whitewashed environment. Like, sometimes you'll go to kinky salon or you'll go to a swingers party and everyone there is white.
Right, which was when I started my program, my initial research into consensual non-monogamy was focused around agreements and negotiations and power. And as I did the background research for my own study, I saw this is a very white demographic. The research is heavily slanted towards one population. The people who are doing the research are heavily slanted towards one population. And it's an absence of both racial identity and also power dynamics. You know, what is it like to be the only one of one thing going into a place where you're already a minority?
Well, and I think it's interesting to think about, like, why would it be harder to be out of the closet as a kinky person, as an open person, as a polyamorous person? Why would it be harder to be out of the closet for some people rather than others?
Right. And I was able to speak with people who had multiple identities that are marginalized. One of the people in the study, he identified as a man. He identified as black. He identified as queer. He identified as a sex worker. And he was the parent of two-year-old girls. He had twin daughters. And he was living in a multi-adult family. There was three adults raising these two kids. And he, you know, he's like, I fit in a little bit everywhere and a little bit nowhere. Mm-hmm. And we had these great conversations about what was it like for him to be in queer spaces that didn't really do kink. What was it like being in kink spaces that didn't do race? What was it like being in parenting space that didn't do sex work?
Yeah, right.
So he, you know, we had some really interesting conversations about where does he get support? Where does he find him whole, his whole self? And really the only place he felt the most at home was his home.
Well, and it's interesting looking at the whole idea of why is intersecting identities important. It's because at the point of those intersections, you get even more potential marginalization because you're going to get marginalized by this group for this identity. And then, you know, so if you're in the book group, you're going to get marginalized by the people who like zoos. And if you're in the zoo group, you're going to get marginalized by the people who like books. Do you know what I mean? Right. So it's just one of those things where if we're not all really conscious and open, which God bless America, we're not. although we're working on it, you know, it can be really hard to have multiple identities, and that's why it's important to study it.
Right, and I feel like sexuality studies is at a place where it needs to decide what's it going to do. Because coming out from the master's program, I was aware of people are comfortable studying one degree of difference. We're really not equipped to study multiple differences in one person's lived experience. And we're going to have to challenge ourselves as sexologists, as social scientists. We're going to have to really get real with what people are dealing with on a daily basis in regards to their sexual identity.
Let's talk about why it's important to look at identity when you're talking about sexuality.
In our country especially, you cannot talk about sexuality without talking about race, gender, socioeconomic status, because those things are accesses to resources. We have so much stigma around sexuality. We have so much shame inherent in our sexuality. I think we live in a sex-negative culture. And then on top of that, sex negativity for everyone, then you have those intersections of multiply marginalized identities. Mm-hmm. African-American situation, the Latina situation. I mean, these are different context-specific sexualities. Mm-hmm. People in my cohort, when I was, you know, we were going through our theses, one woman was studying what is it like for Latina women, you know, first-generation Mexican-Americans, how do they navigate their sexuality when their family came from Mexico and they're here in California? Mm-hmm. What do they do? Another woman was studying HIV positive African-American women, and they live in Oakland, and what are their resources like? I mean, those intersecting identities matter so much when we're asking these larger questions about sex.
Well, it really plays into risk, and it also plays into health outcomes, access to health care, and those things are so important to our sexuality. But then also, you know, are we empowered? You know, do we feel like we have the right to ask for someone to use a condom? Do we have the right to say yes or to say no? You know, do we have the right to be freaky and open? You know, do we have the right to be who we really are?
Right. And I think those coming out stories was something that my thesis captured that I was excited to have, looking at how individual people kind of constantly negotiate their level of outness. One woman in the study, you know, she was not out to her parents about being kinky, about being bisexual, about being poly, but she was definitely out to her children. And she was making age-appropriate conversations pretty continuous in her household to let her 12-year-old know, you know, I have two boyfriends, to let her 5-year-old know.
Right. That's normal, right?
Right, you know, and her
that's
daughter.
Normal.
Right, and her daughter was like, Mom, you know, I'm uncomfortable with what if my friends know? And the woman was very clear to say to her daughter, I'm not asking you to keep my secrets for me. Mm-mm. I am not asking you to hold this. If you want me to have any conversation with anyone, I will.
Right.
But that was a conscious decision to be different from what she learned from her parents. Who were still, you know, they were Catholic, and everyone was married from death to you part, and they had generations of monogamy. Mm-hmm. So this woman was making her own story as she went, and I really was happy to capture that and to relay her story to a larger audience, because I'm sure there are other people going through the same things.
Well, and because we're not talking about sexuality in our culture so much, it's kind of, you kind of feel like you have to reinvent the wheel. And I certainly felt like I was reinventing the wheel, like I was the only person who'd ever had sex. And now I'm talking to my parents, like now that they're 60 and they're not afraid to tell me the truth about what they were like as young people. And I find out that my parents they had sex and they just didn't talk about it to me. And so I was going without a roadmap entirely.
Oh, yes, exactly. And I think those scripts exist for us as individuals, and they exist for communities. I mean, if each generation of a community is feeling like they're the only ones who've done it, they're missing out on that generational knowledge. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's something that we talk about a lot in the queer community, you know, of you know, young queers learning from older queers and understanding that generational process. I think the same thing can happen for kinky people, for poly people, for the understanding that you're going to differentiate. But what if you could have access to that knowledge? And I feel like as researchers, as social scientists, it's kind of our job to make those stories more available to people.
Mm-hmm. And how do you have a healthy relationship around sexuality with, you know, adolescents or, you know, young people or children or 3-year-olds or babies? Or what is a healthy relationship to sexuality? Because that's something we're not really addressing right now.
Correct. And I think that's one of the reasons why
we're just avoiding it.
We're avoiding it, and we're so conditioned to not trust our own instincts. Especially as a woman, as a mom, I know that when I was raising my kids, I realized, I'm going to do this differently. And I don't really know what that means. Where do I go? Who's going to help me do this differently this time and talk openly and age appropriately with my children and make sure they're protected? And I think for me, sex positivity as a parent is a lot about protecting and equipping my children to understand, you know, their own urges, their own healthy versus, you know, the abuse that we see or the targeting of children or how we can help kids protect themselves when they are out in the world. And I think sex positivity is a huge part of that.
We're now talking about your book, Sex Positive Parenting. So that's exciting. And we were going to get there anyway, but we've already jumped in. The Sex Positive Parenting is really empowering kids to say yes and to say no and educating them. And how much information do you give a three-year-old? And how do you make that call?
Right. And I think there's a large body of work. I mean, there's a lot of child psychology. There's a lot of development out there. There's a lot of information that parents can take to see at different ages kids are ready for different information. What I'm hoping to help parents with is their own shame. I think we have the body of knowledge to see kids are prepared for certain things at certain times. You as a parent have to not be afraid of going there with them.
Could you say more about that? Like at the age of 3 and then the age of 6, I mean, what are the different lines? I mean, because kids, I mean, my experience of being a child, I definitely was interested in sex in certain ways. And then, you know, maybe some amount of sexuality was too much, you know. And so like I would maybe play games or have fantasies or imagine things at 6 or 8 or 10. But then I wasn't ready for any kind of whole enchilada, certainly.
Right. And as a parent, you want to protect your children. You want to give them the space to grow and to develop safely. And, you know, you're the guardian of so many different parts of their life. Mm-hmm. And I think all parents want their kids to grow up with a healthy sense of self, which leads to a healthy sense of sexuality. And I feel like, you know, there's been so much feminist literature on raising girls to know their body parts and for boys to not feel shame about touching themselves. And, you know, you've got this idea around, okay, we can be private. You deserve pleasure. We have to talk about those things as they arise, right? Like, you don't have to tell your kids something they're not asking you about yet.
Totally. But I, you know, one of the things that I wish I had gotten from my parents is, like, this would be a good thing to do around this kind of person, and it would be nice to know this person really well before you do this. Yeah. You know, as a 16-year-old, or, and I don't know, something, and I think something about just never talking about sex really made it feel to me like I couldn't even talk to my partners about sex or what I wanted or what I didn't want. And then, you know, I just got all sorts of really wrong ideas. You know what I mean?
Right, right. And I think that's part of being a sex positive person is that you have the language to say good sex versus bad sex. And
right.
You can really say that on lots of levels. You can say that from an adult version of, you know, I know what sex makes me happy. You can say it to a child of someone can give you inappropriate sexual attention and it's not your fault. Mm-hmm. It's not your fault if you're too afraid to say no. It's not your fault if you liked it for a moment. It's not your fault if someone gives you bad sexual attention. Mm-hmm. That is a different experience than you being a sexual person. We have to give that language to our kids. And I remember being when my sons, because I have two sons, I remember when they were 3 and they started going to preschool, I had to sit them down and have this conversation. If someone touches you, tell me. And it was so heartbreaking to me that I had to arm my kids. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I was like, you know, this is part of a larger conversation. We're going to be talking about this their whole lives. Mm-hmm. Consent, it's going to change. You know, when they're children, it's about not being hurt. When they become teenage men, teenage boys, it's going to be about respecting partners' boundaries. Like, we're going to be talking about consent their whole lives.
Right. That's interesting. Yeah, I think the not talking about it really feeds into the problem that we have with consent in our culture. We don't know how to ask for consent. We oftentimes blame rape victims for being raped because they were wearing a red dress or they were in the wrong neighborhood or they went up to his bedroom or what were they expecting wearing that outfit or I don't know, whatever. They blame them, you know, and I really think that it's interesting. Like, how can we have a conversation about sex and consent that gives room for people to have desires? You know, it's okay for you to have a desire, but like, hey, you know, why don't you really respect someone's autonomy? And like, let's share pleasure.
Right, right. And I feel like you have to understand what autonomy is and experience it as yourself before you can really understand it in someone else. And I think, right? And giving children autonomy over their own body at a young age makes it a not foreign idea to introduce someone at 25. If you're going to have these conversations for the first time in college, it's going to be a foreign concept. Mm-hmm. So you have these young, like, your body belongs to you. That means everyone you meet, their body belongs to them. Mm-hmm. And you don't get to touch them without their consent, and they don't get to touch you without your consent. And that goes forever. There's no expiration date on that dynamic.
So does that mean that you can't say, because I said so, and create a hierarchy?
It's really difficult in my household, for sure. I do a lot of explaining. My kids are been taught to be critical thinkers, and if they don't understand what I'm talking about, they're going to challenge me. So we talk a lot about everything, and sex is just one of the many things we have pretty exhaustive conversations about.
Oh, Well, I'm sure you also have to talk about, like, why you can't cross the street and why you can't wear plaid with stripes. And actually, you can.
We actually just had that conversation about plaids and stripes. My son came out of the dressing room in, like, this fantastic outfit. I'm like, I love you. You're in middle school. There's no way you can wear that in the playground. You will just get demolished. You're wearing plaid bottom, striped top. The colors look great. No.
It's adorable. I love you. You're fantastic. But I'm sorry. I don't think that's safe.
Right, exactly. I'm like, I value your self-esteem.
And what did he say?
He was pretty upset. He tried 3 or 4 different outfits, and he kept going back to the same thing. I'm like, no, it doesn't work that way.
It should, though. In a perfect world, it should be. You should be able to wear whatever your freaky little self wants to wear, you cutie. But yeah, no, I know the stripes and the plaid. Sometimes we just, yeah, and then you're drawing attention to yourself, and I think that works the same way with, you know, sexuality and attractiveness, you know?
And it happens at a young age. I know, you know, I have to do a balancing act between talking about my children too much. I want to respect their privacy and their autonomy. And even though I've been a parent long enough now to where I have a huge amount of stories, like, oh, well, there's one time at this one playground, this one thing happened. But I'm like, well, how much of those are my own stories to tell? And how much, you know, how much of their experience do I want to share publicly? Mm. And that's difficult. So I'm hoping to, you know, speak with other parents more. And we can have this kind of accumulation effect. So that way it's not just one person's experience. Like, I think about Dossie Easton with her experience with her daughter and, you know, how she had to balance out, I want to give these examples and be, a, you know, a leader in this revolution.
Right. Yeah, but also, like, respecting the privacy of your kid.
Right, exactly. And she's had to, and I'm like, okay. And that, to me, is an example of intergenerational knowledge. Dossie did this. What can I learn from Dossie? How much of my children do I want to talk about? And I'm thinking, I mean, the first story is, you know, my son wears a baggy jacket all the time. And I'm like, you know, it's getting warm outside. Why are you wearing this baggy jacket? And he's feeling very self-conscious about his body. You know, he's of the age and he's, and especially his, like, lower half. Like, he has, you know, he's getting stronger and bigger and he's feeling very self-conscious. And it took him a while to get that conversation out to me about, okay, well, what are you feeling? Why do you want to hide your body? Like, what is that about? And he's a boy. You know, boys aren't supposed to feel that way, right? Like, we're told the only
right.
girls...
Right, boys aren't supposed to have self-image issues.
Right, exactly.
Except for that they totally do, and that's okay.
And it's
and
totally
let's talk
okay.
about that.
Yes, let's talk about it. I would like to do my parenting from a very non-gender binary space. Like,
right.
I really think the gender binary hurts children. I think it hurts parents. And I feel like it's detrimental to us helping our kids grow. If we make these steadfast rules of boys do this and girls do that, it's like, you know, that's not true, and it hurts.
Mm-hmm. Well, that and it doesn't allow women to be their full selves if part of that self includes being a boy or being a man or having some masculine qualities, you know. And we don't want men necessarily to suppress their feminine qualities, which often include emotions and sensitivity and appreciation of beauty and a lot of different things.
Right. My sons just had sex education at their school, and it was great. And I knew the educator from my own program a couple years back, so I was really happy that the school had hired this one educator. And my older son came home, and he's like, Mom, have you heard the expression man up?
Oh, and he'd never heard that before.
He had never heard it.
Love it.
I know. And I was like,
love that he'd never heard that one. That's a new one.
Right.
Awesome.
Right. I was like, I win.
Yes. Yeah. Man up is a dumb thing that people used to say when they said, like, you have to be stronger and be a man and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
That's so great.
It was great. And, you know, and we're very man large up. People. Like, we're big. We're you know, large people. So if you're going to look at this boy who's, you know, already bigger than everybody else and tell him he's not manly enough, and he's like, I'm going to cry if I feel like crying. I'm going to be happy if I feel like being happy. And I'm going to tell you, like, you're a jerk when you're being a jerk to other women. It's like, yes, that's my son.
That's right. Let's talk about some of your other books. I know that you have some other stories rolling around in your head. Tell me about them.
Well, based upon the thesis research that I did, it was amazing. While I was doing this research, there was another man in Oakland who was organizing a polyamorous people of color group. And he was creating space and meetings, and it was the first time it had been done. And so, you know, I reached out to him. I said, look, I'm doing this research on the community that you're organizing. Maybe we should get together and we should work on this, you know, because I feel like my research is mostly for the community that I'm researching. I don't want to just turn around and give it back to academia. It's not my... It doesn't go well with my ethos, because the people who participated in my study did so from a place of advocacy. They were very aware they were sharing their story for a larger audience. It wasn't about me embedding myself in their culture. It was, hi, what would you like the world to know about you? And so the two of us have kind of worked on, like, okay, well, we can make this into a bigger project. We actually can combine his lived experience as a polyamorous man of color, his experience as a community organizer, and his experience in Oakland. And then we can combine that with my theory and research and the amount of analyzation that I did with this body of work that I was able to do over 2 years.
What were some of the surprising things that, you know, or the things that interested you about your work doing an ethnography of, you know, people of color who are open?
Because my experience, I mean, I'm from Oakland, and, you know, in my own experiences with non-monogamy, it was very much a multiracial experience for me. It was, the people that I was dating, the people that I was friends with, the people that I saw in community spaces around non-monogamy, not everyone identified as polyamorous. They might identify as open. They might identify as having agreements. But when I saw, like, well, wait, the literature I'm reading doesn't represent this at all. The literature, the studies, this whole other community or this whole other layer of non-monogamy is not being discussed. And that seemed not just wrong, but it seemed very ignorant. And I'm like, I don't want to contribute to the continued ignorance of my own field. So if there are people who want to talk to me, then let's talk. And I feel like the strategies employed by the people that I studied are pretty universal for anyone who's coming into a place of being othered. The othering experience, you know, going into a space knowing you're going to be the only person who has your shared, you know, culture or your shared identity. And how does that work? How does that feel?
Yeah, and a lot of people haven't had that experience until they travel to a foreign country, for instance. You know, when I went to Japan and I was the only person with blonde hair, it was a new experience. And it's something that I think, you know, until you have that experience, it's kind of hard to understand. So what are some of the things that you found out?
I found out that hyper-visibility and hyper-invisibility can be really painful in trying to find, like, shared experiences. That if you're coming to a group asking for stories of, like, how did you come out to your parents about having two partners that you live with? Or what is it like for you to be out in your workplace? And there's this huge barrier because they look at you differently. And they really don't understand that you're a whole person. You're not just what makes you different.
Yeah. And it's both ends of that spectrum. Like, if someone's always asking you, if you're always the poster child for being transgender, you're always the poster child for being black, or you're always the poster child for being whatever it is, then that can feel like, ugh. But then if you're always, you know, if no one's noticing, if no one's looking at you, if no one's, you know, giving you any attention, that's also really awful.
Right. And for me, you know, interracial relationships are the norm in both my family and both my community. And I want to know what my partners are experiencing. I want to better understand their position in this community. I don't want it to be just critique. I don't want it to be just, you know, saying these same things we've heard before about isolation and, you know, minority status of different kinds of minorities, sexual minority, racial minority, gender minority. But if I'm going to be in relationships with people, I need to know what their experience is. And if we're going to be from different backgrounds, how do we come together and how do we speak the same language around relationships? Mm-hmm. We have to have those templates. We don't have them. Mm-hmm. So we need to make them.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting that I think now that the polyamory community and the sexuality community, they're starting to have conferences and events, and there's actually a field, you know, there's studies, academic studies of sexuality. Woo! So tell me about the Poly Conference that was just here in San Francisco.
It was so great. It was OpenSF, the people who organized it, I just give them so much props. Having been to many academic conferences, this was one of my first non-academic. It was organized around, I mean, I've been to, you know, International Miss Leather Conference, but most of my time has been with academic. And, you know, how painful that can be if you are different, if you aren't mainstream, you know, if you aren't what the researchers look like, if you're not what the professors look like, how painful that can be. So OpenSF, they did such a good job being integrated, but I want to say being aware of their privilege. Like, they were very much aware that we need to be different. If we're going to have a conversation about polyamory that's not the same conversation we've been having, we need kinky people. We need people of color. We need families. We need, you know, people who identify as multiple gendered. You know, we have to be different if we want to walk our talk. And they did it.
Tell me about some of the things that you learned at OpenSF.
I learned so much.
I bet you met so many neat people.
I did. And I wanted to let, yeah, yes, I did. They were, many room numbers were exchanged. It was fantastic.
There's that too, right? A poly conference,
right.
Sure.
right. The keynotes that I went to were phenomenal. The keynote by Yosenio and Ignacio, you know, talking about kink, race, and class, talking about the language of eroticism and exoticism.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like, you know, I don't want to be the exotic other all the fucking time.
Right.
You know, I want to actually go in and have my wishes granted. I want to be seen as a person. I don't want to be seen as what fulfills your fantasy. Mm-hmm. And that's a big statement to make, because in BDSM spaces, in kinky spaces, you know, I want to come in and have my wishes respected. And that was something I haven't really heard many people say on such a large scale. Like, they were saying that to hundreds of people. You have to respect who I am in these spaces. Which was fantastic. And the poly parenting was great. I mean, to talk about family structures, to talk about what it's like to raise children in a polyamorous family. Like, that spoke to, you know, my wishes and my desire to not be segregated, to be my whole sexual self, my whole parenting self, and to see other people's strategies and how they create support networks around it. Tristan gave an amazing, Tristan Taramino gave a great keynote about, if you can be open, please do. Like, if you can come out about your kink, about your poly, do it. You know, not everyone can. Some people are completely limited in how open they can be. Other people, if you can, please do it. And that was just a...
Because you create a world where people are like, oh, people are different. Like, we live in this world, I think, where everyone's just pretending to be normal. And especially when I go to San Jose and everyone's totally pretending to be normal, and they're pretending to be businesslike and pretending to not have, you know, differentness and openness and sexuality and weirdness. I mean, everyone's just dampening down their freak flag, and it's just so nice. Not only is it nice to be your authentic self, but then also it really creates a culture of openness that we have been avoiding by pretending to be normal.
Right, and I was thinking about, like, what's a good metaphor for this? Like, how can we think about this? And I'm thinking about being vaccinated. You know, like, if we create a culture of openness, if we all come out just a little bit, it'll reduce that stigma. Because to me, stigma is the disease. Like, stigma is the problem. People feeling shame, people being hurt, people being held accountable for things that are natural and normal. And I feel like if we all come out just a little bit, it'll create this openness around society. Mm-hmm. And of course, the most privileged people need to come out first, because they have the most support and resources. Mm-hmm. And, you know, then that those layers can bleed into other areas. You know, parents still have a really hard time being clear and open about their sexuality. It's just it's very taboo. It's very scary.
Well, it's such a landmine, because I think a lot of people think, well, if I tell my kids about sex, then they'll want to have sex. Like, you're opening Pandora's box.
Right. Right. And what's also scary is, if you think the way you have sex is wrong, you don't want to teach your children to be like you. If you don't believe that what you're doing is right and healthy and normal, you don't want to pass that on to your kids. And so you stay closeted and you stay hidden and you hope they go do the right thing, because society is right and you are wrong.
Right, and you're giving them the tools to blow up their own experience from scratch. Awesome.
Yeah, right. And it's, you know, it's a painful thing to see that parents have to internalize so much of their own, those negative stories about their sexuality, that they're afraid. Like, they're literally afraid that they're going to make their child a social outcast.
Right.
And when all kids really want is information, and all they really want is safety... And, you know, they want to learn from you as your parent. They want to learn from you. And I feel like we need to learn the difference between bad sex and good sex, and acknowledge that, you know, people in the BDSM scene, people who are kinky, people who are poly, they have a lot to offer in world experience. And being quiet all the time isn't helping anyone.
Well, what's wonderful about the BDSM community is they're like, well, here's the difference between good sex and bad sex. It's consent. It's whether or not I like it. You know what I mean? And, like, to have someone just come out and say that. It's not whether or not it's hurt. It hurts. It's not whether or not it's weird. It's not whether or not your mom thinks it's okay or your church thinks it's okay. It's whether or not you enjoy pleasure and you say yes at the beginning with your clothes on.
Right. Right. And I feel like the next project, the next book that I really want to work on is an anthology of parents who have an alternative sexuality and what their parenting experiences have been, because I feel like we can learn from each other, and that those powerful narratives, like the power of the narrative to share, okay, I went through this as a parent, as a person with a sexuality that I identify with, and I feel like we're ready. I feel like we're ready. As a culture, I think we're ready to have those stories be available to more people.
Oh, absolutely. Ariel Clark, I think there's one more book that we haven't talked about, right?
Right. Well, there's
isn't she great?
I've been busy. Grad school was like a huge percolation. It was just, I've never spent so much time alone, so much time with, you know, me and my laptop. I actually melted the bottom of my MacBook. I was on it so much.
Oh. Yeah, you need to let it cool.
Yeah, I didn't. Okay. No, I just kept going for hours. So
I melted it.
I did. I melted my MacBook. So there's.
Because your work is so hot.
I don't think of it that way, but yeah.
So totally.
Totally hot. So there's the book based on the thesis research in the community. There's I would love to do the anthology with, you know, multiple voices from parents who have an alternative sexuality, talking about their parenting experiences. And then I would like to do just a larger general the sex positive parent. And that would be, you know, not necessarily about a marginalized sexual identity, but just about what conversations can anyone have with their children about sex. And some of it would draw from my own experience as a parent. Also, it would come from all the research I've done on what kids are ready for, what kids need to hear, and how can parents be the first and primary sex educator for their children?
Right. Age-appropriate information. What age is appropriate for what information?
Right. And I have, you know, I remember being, you know, a young parent. I mean, I had children really young, so I didn't really have this time to develop a sexuality, a priority to being a parent. These things happen at the same time for me. And I really worked hard to reject those cultural scripts that told me I had to choose. And I thought to myself, you know, my kids are going to benefit from me not hiding who I am. They're going to benefit from having honest and frank conversations about whatever they're worried about. Because kids do have anxiety. They watch TV. They hear things on, you know, they hear things on the playground. They come home and they're confused and they need someone to talk to. And if you're not that person, well, who is? And I've always been really proud of being that person and working really hard to deal with, okay, if I don't know the answer, I'm going to go find it, but I'm going to come back to it. I'm not going to let it hang. I'm going to have these conversations and be as engaged of a parent as I can be, because I feel like that's the best way to protect them, one, and two, to raise conscientious, sex-positive, healthy adults.
Right. And you're also doing some work with the Sex Positive Photo Project.
Right. I've been working with Shiloh for a while. She's a fantastic photographer.
Yes, she is.
We love Shiloh, but she needed someone to help write and to help craft and bring a little bit of like the social science theory to her work, because what she's doing is pretty revolutionary. She's working really hard to highlight the people who are in our community, taking those chances, making those leaps, doing the art, doing the work around sex positivity.
Yeah, and it's not always easy to be open. You know, like, it's sexual freedom isn't easy. Like, being easy isn't easy.
No, it's not. And I think we've regressed as a society. I feel like we've had peaks and valleys with sexual acceptance. And those moments of, you know, of dips look what's happening right now in Congress. Look what's happening with the war on women and these men not wanting a woman to say the word vagina.
I know. Two women got barred from Congress. No, from the floor of the House for saying the word vagina in an anti-choice, talking about anti-choice legislation, just said, you know, frankly, sir, I am flattered that you're interested in my vagina, but I would be frankly happier if you would not legislate it.
Right, right. And the uproar and, you know, and having,
she said vagina.
She said, and this other congressman, he said, I wouldn't say that word in mixed company. And I'm like,
I know.
What?
Really?
How?
It's not a bad word. Vagina is not a bad word.
Right. Right. So we're all supposed to be pretending we don't. I mean, there's so many different ways that's wrong.
Oh, we're pretending we don't have genitals, first of all.
Right. Because babies just come out of where?
Your stork.
Right. They get delivered. FedEx.
Mail.
Right. We have a whole FedEx birth department.
Well, and it comes with, like, the whole thing of, like, shaming and... But then the thing is you can pretend that you're not legislating about sex, that you're not legislating about gender, that you're not having a war on women because you're not talking about it.
Right. Right. And I feel like as a... You know, I'm a woman and I'm raising two men. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I do not want to raise those kinds of men. I do not ever want to have.
It's not even possible, don't worry.
Okay, but it keeps you up at night sometimes.
I know, I'm sure. But the interesting thing is I wonder when you're really open and poly and whatever you are. I mean, I wonder, like, if your kids are going to rebel and get a little bit conservative.
Oh, I have that.
Are they?
The Alex P. Keaton fear. You remember from Family Ties, that TV show?
Yeah.
How the parents were so open and cool, and they had their first son was this complete ass.
Right.
And like, oh my gosh. Please don't ever do that. But yeah. Again, part
of... Do they rebel against you in sort of conservative ways ever?
Not yet. Because, I mean, you know, they still don't know a lot. You know, I wonder when they're teenagers. Like, and part of me thinks, oh, we want to control the rebellion that our children do. So we might come across more conservative on purpose. That's like a management strategy, right? Like, I'm going to tell my kids I'm super conservative. So that way when they do rebel, they don't go too far afield.
Well, you know, it's funny because, I mean, as teenagers, you're going to explore. And you're going to explore things that are different than your parents. And I definitely went through a whole exploration of religion, of finding, trying to find community, trying to find truth, trying to find spiritual truth. And I went right into conservative, born-again religion. I went to Baptists, I went to the Mormons, and I was like, really, what's true here? Really, what's true about, is there justice in the world? Does God save little babies before they're baptized? You know, like, what is the truth? And so it's interesting, like, to watch... You know, of course, the children of conservative parents are often liberal. We've heard that story. But then, you know, the Alex P. Keatons of the world, you know.
Right. Well, and then there's also that generation idea of, you know, in the United States, we had the World War II generation, you know, baby boomers, the hippies, the punks. I mean, we can see these generations rebelling against each other and how that works. And I really hope that my kids don't pick up dogma from me. Like, I would really like to be a dogma free.
Yeah.
I don't want to be a pusher of sex. I don't want to be a pusher of sexuality. I would like them to have a clear understanding that mom wants us to be safe and mom wants us to be healthy. Mm-hmm. And if they want to rebel against that, you know, then I can't.
Just be autonomous. That's all I
That's
ask.
That's it.
Just do what you want. Only what you want to do.
Just think for yourself.
Yeah,
please.
Totally.
I do not want to raise sheep.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So if you could share something with people that live in a less sex-positive community, the people, you know, are living in Kazakhstan or Saudi Arabia or China, what do you think would be the first steps to openness with your kids?
The first step is to make the decision that you're going to do something different. That's the first step. The first step is acknowledging the fact, okay, I'm not as equipped for this as I'd like to be. And make a decision to go out and find those resources wherever you can to make those decisions early and commit yourself to being different.
Where have you found good sex-positive parenting information?
My grandmother. My mother's mother was probably the most honest, the most open about sex with her children, with her grandchildren. She's still alive, and I'm grateful for her. But she was the first person I heard the word kinky from, because I was young, and she was talking to some of her friends, and I was sitting on the floor, and I was probably 4 or 5, and she said K-I-N-K-Y, and I'm being this.
And you're, of course, being like, what does that mean?
Kinky. Well, someone had described my hair as being kinky just recently, because I have this crazy curly hair, and someone said, oh, you have kinky hair. And I was like, oh, so when I heard my grandmother spell out kinky, I sounded it out. I made it. I'm like, I know what that means. And my grandmother was like, oh, really? Go ahead. What does it mean? I'm like, it means my hair. And she said, no, it means adventurous sex.
Oh, my God. Good for her.
And I was like, oh, shit. Grandma is not playing.
Yeah.
And she was the one. I mean, she was the one. My grandmother talked about abortion. She talked about birth control, she talked about men, she talked about power, in a conversational tone over coffee cake.
Amen, Grandma. But where would someone in China find good sex-positive information for parents? Scarlatine? So that's scarlatine.com. Where else?
Well, it depends. I mean, China, of course, having their censorship issues.
I know. So, oh, my God. Can you imagine how hard it is?
I mean, we...
They have Sexploration with Monica, and that's it.
Right. That's awesome.
They haven't banned us yet.
Well, I would say podcasts are a fantastic way, because I feel like getting peers and contemporary knowledge is really important. So, I mean, podcasts are amazing. Scarlatine is, I mean, if anyone, if you can support Scarlet Teen, support Scarlet Teen. Planned Parenthood has been a great source. I mean, I remember being a teenager myself, and Planned Parenthood was the number one spot that I went for anything that I was too uncomfortable to talk to my parents about or talk to my peers about. I would go to Planned Parenthood to answer my peers' questions because I trusted that source so much. So again, they're under fire for a reason, too. They give out great information.
Yeah, and it's funny how they try to talk about, like, well, they give abortions. Actually, very little of the care they give is abortions. Most of it is health information and birth control.
Right, and again, non-dogmatic. You know, they don't have an agenda other than to keep people healthy. Mm-hmm. That's their whole thing, just to keep people healthy. And I feel like if you are in a place where you don't have access to that kind of care, if you can't go to your doctor and ask about those things, if your pediatrician is no way ever going to talk about sex with your kids, you're going to have to supplement that information.
Yeah. It's a lot of times just kids don't get any information. And luckily, maybe they get a library card. They get to read Where Do I Come From? Or what's the puberty version of that book? Where Do I Come From? And then there's like, what's happening to me
what's
now?
What's happening to my body? Yes, yes.
What is happening to my body? Yeah, totally. And luckily, you get that amount of information. But there's so much more to learn and to talk about. You know, autonomy, consent, you know, senses of safety, physical safety in terms of are you using protection, but are you also ready to have sex? Are you ready to have a relationship? What kind of relationship do you want? What does it look like when you share pleasure? It could look like this. It could look like just touching. It doesn't have to look like sex. You don't always have to have, you know what I mean? Because sometimes we think that sex is only,
right.
you know, enchilada, full
right.
sex, but
right.
it doesn't have to be.
No, and especially if we're going to really acknowledge the wide range of sexualities that exist. If we're really going to put effort and time into nurturing whatever your sexuality looks like, then you have to tell them there's nuances. You have to tell them that what you do may not be what your friends do. And I think that building social support networks around sexuality has been so important for older generations, but there's no reason to not do that at the teenage years. There's no reason to have shame if you're not hetero or if you're not cis or if you're not, you know, vanilla. There's no shame in being afraid of sex. There's no shame in being curious about other kinds of sex. Like, there's no shame in actually thinking, I see what's out there. I think I want something different. Where can I find it?
So she said, I'm not cis, which means I'm not cisgendered, which means I'm not same gendered, which means when you were born, you have the biology of, say, a woman, for instance, and then you also have the gender expression of a woman, so you express yourself as a woman. So transgender means, you know, I have a gender identity that is different than the biology with which I was born, so that's cisgendered and transgendered. I just wanted to break
that
down.
Thank you. And I also think that in the sexuality studies field, we're finally getting a good grasp of what the gender not the gender spectrum.
Yeah.
You know, we're learning.
It's not just
that,
a binary.
No, and we're.
Nothing's a binary ever, pretty much.
Yeah, get over it.
Yeah, totally.
It doesn't exist.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. It makes your
black
world
and
easy.
White. No, actually, white is all colors, black is the absence of light. Yeah. Booyah. Physics.
Physics. Basic physics. Basic understanding of lived experiences. You don't have to look too far to find exceptions to all these rules.
Exactly.
So when does the rules don't count anymore?
Yeah. Yeah, well, we have, you know, these boxes that we like to make in our minds, but they're just in our minds. So, you know, keep making the boxes, but make a new box. And which one works best? And which one creates the most joy and the most autonomy and pleasure and, you know.
Right. Well, I think the goal is to, one is to reduce stigma in society, but there's also to reduce shame in the person. Mm-hmm. And that's a two-pronged approach to really living a healthy sexuality. And if you feel proud of who you are, you won't let people walk all over you. You won't make those risky decisions. You won't put yourself in danger not knowing that you're doing it,
mm-hmm.
because you'll have a sense of self that's supported. And I feel like as a parent, it's heartbreaking to look around and see the choices people make because they don't feel whole or they don't feel supported for their whole self. And I feel as we can change that. It's actually 100% doable to change that.
Right, we were talking about so-called sex addiction, where you can get into a loop of a negative damaging behavior, maybe high-risk sex with a stranger or something like that, and then you get a temporary rush, and then you start to feel guilty and shamed, and then you feel bad or you're sick or whatever happens. You know, you're not supported by your society. You have to live in shame or secret, and then it kind of feeds back into itself, and so that shame is actually part of the problem. And could you have a healthy sexual expression? How would that affect, you know, so-called sex addiction?
Right, and I feel like the sex addiction is, it's a very problematic dynamic. Like, this, it's just so painful to look at how people are willing to replicate a cycle we know that doesn't work. You know, the harm reduction versus the absolution, or the, you are a sex addict if you're always going to be a sex addict. You have to be a sex addict forever. And you're going to be forever.
Oh, well, and technically, I mean, I just did a huge interview about this with Dr. David Lay, which if you haven't listened to it, please do. He wrote the book, The Myth of Sex Addiction, which is about basically that we're not really addicted. It's just that we feel addicted. It's like we feel addicted to Facebook. We don't actually have a chemical addiction to Facebook. We don't have a chemical addiction to sex. I mean, if we are experiencing pleasure chemicals as a result of our sexual activity, which is great, that's a chemical that's meant to be in your body. It's manufactured by your brain. It's not the same kind of addiction that someone has. Like, if you quit alcohol cold turkey, you'll actually die. You know, if you quit heroin cold turkey, you'll actually, you know, go into delirium tremens. I mean, there's like a whole physiological reaction that you have. That isn't what's happening with sex. It's just that we feel compelled. And some of that being compelled is about our shame around it. And how do we start to unwind that?
Right. I have a friend who had that experience, and he was someone who had been taught that there was two kinds of people in the world. There are good eggs and bad eggs.
Binary bad eggs.
Good eggs and bad eggs. And he really believed that if he, you know, he believed he himself was a bad egg.
Right.
And that he needed to meet good eggs. But those good eggs could never know how bad he was.
Right. So and he had to be secret.
He was secretive. His sexuality was completely secret. And the more he fell in love with someone, the less access they had to his sexuality.
Oh, no.
And well, what does that lead to?
Bad sex.
Bad sex with the person you're in love with.
Or no sex.
Or you go and you find illicit sex.
Or cheating.
Cheating.
Ew.
Cheating. And as someone who, you know,
non-consensual, non-monogamy.
Non-consensual, non-monogamy.
Blarg.
Right. And this, you know, and I remember I said to him, I'm like, when are you going to address this whole binary thing you have going on? When are you going to stop seeing the world in good and bad eggs? Because it's pretty much biting you in the ass.
Right.
It's not helping you.
Right.
There's other ways.
That box that you made in your brain is not a helpful one anymore. Maybe you should recycle it.
Right. And I think that that's what happens as parents. It's really lazy parenting to depend upon those boxes that have been made for us. It's easy to do. You know, it takes the work off of you, that you don't have to raise critical thinkers. You don't have to be critical of your own biases. You don't have to challenge your own assumptions. You can just pass on.
You don't have to think about your own stories.
At all. Right. A bit. And that's the challenge. Like, I think that's why we need support. We need books. We need podcasts. We need support groups where we can talk about, I'm going to challenge this bunch of assumptions I was handed. Mm-hmm. Help.
Right. Well, Ariel Clark, how do people find you if they want to learn more about your book? Do you have any websites or books that you've...
I do. Oh, well, the books are, they're all still formulating.
They're still hatching.
They're hatching. But right now you can find me at thesexpositiveparent.com. And we're also on Facebook. You can find The Sex Positive Parent there as well.
Excellent. Thank you so much. This has been such a pleasure.
Great. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Guess who I have sitting next to me? The one, the only, Vagina Jenkins. Welcome to Sexploration with Monica.
Thank you for having me. And hi, everyone out here. It's the lady, Miss Vagina Jenkins, and she loves you.
So what have you been doing with yourself these days, lady?
Well, I've been taking my clothes off, and my mother does approve, so it's okay. Don't worry out there, listeners. I basically just moved to Oakland, and I'm living my dream. Seriously, like, non-ironically, living my dream and making magic happen and taking my clothes off while I'm doing it. So, yeah.
So tell me more about this whole, I mean, this is a burlesque show that you're doing, or is it striptease?
Oh, you're talking about for the circus?
Yes.
Okay, so the thing about the circus that I'm super excited about is that striptease was born in the circus, in the hooch tent. Ah. So I'm bringing hooch tent realness. Yes, absolutely.
So the history of the hooch tent is, I've never heard of the hooch tent. What is a hooch tent? And what do we mean by hooch? Does that mean vagina?
It does. It does. You can call it the hooch tent or the cooch tent. But yeah, the hooch tent was where...
Or hoochie coochie.
Exactly. Right. The hooch tent was all where all the filthy young people went to get their little groove on. So yeah, and there was a lot of striptease, sex acts, and general adult entertainment.
Like actual live sex shows?
Yes, yes.
Like actual sex?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes, people don't know that, but it actually happened, especially in smaller towns where they knew that they could get away with it. Or in the case of competitive circuses, you had to sort of up the ante and things happened. Things happened.
Oh, interesting. See, there's all these things about our history that we just don't know because we that was not in my history book in school, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, they don't tell you about that. Also, did you know, and I was just talking about this with Jisley, is that...
None other than queer performer Jisley, ladies and gentlemen.
Is that pole dancing was also born from the circus, and they used to call the pole, and it was the center pole of the hooch tent, and they used to call it the snortin' pole. So, yeah, that's what I'm currently at work on is how can I incorporate striptease, old school pole dancing, and general naughtiness in the next year.
What is the snorting pole? What does that even mean? Snorting? Like snorting? Like snorting when you laugh?
No, snorting like a pig, because that's what those men did when ladies got up on the snorting pole.
Oh, stop it. Really?
It's true.
Oh, ew.
It's true.
Because that's what makes them more attractive. Why don't you snort like a pig? Oh, wow. Oh, the history of sex positive culture. See? The hilarity.
And now you know.
Yeah. So as you're living your dreams, taking off your clothes, making beautiful art, what are some of the themes that you focus on when you're putting together an act?
Well, generally, what I like to focus on is the history of working class women doing sex work, specifically strip teasing, and how that kind of class consciousness and all that good stuff leads to me sort of trying to hold space and remember their histories. Mm-hmm. So all of my stuff, no matter where you see me, is sort of based and has a foundation in holding space for those women. Yeah.
And tell me about the name Vagina Jenkins. It seems there's some context there. Contextualization.
Why are you so filthy? You weren't raised right, I believe. You were not
no,
raised
I was.
Right.
And then what happened? I don't know.
So yeah, the lady, Miss Vagina Jenkins, I had to think of the most beautiful and memorable thing that I could name myself after. And who doesn't remember a vagina?
It's true. No, of course everyone. Yeah, and your name is very easy to remember, Vagina Jenkins.
It rolls off the tongue.
Off the tongue, yes. And then it goes la la la. Wait. And what's the Jenkins part?
Oh, it's a proper Southern Black last name.
Ah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So there you have it.
Double history action going on there.
Exactly.
Fantastic. So tell me about some of the shows that you're doing coming up.
Well, at the end of the month, let's see, it's June 28th through 30th. I'll be at the African American Cultural Center as part of Queer Rebels of the Harlem Renaissance. You can find out more information about that at www.queerrebels.com. Let's see, also in August, I'll be doing a Andy Warhol-themed show for Livid Cult Burlesque Theater. And then the September Circus.
Mm, yeah. Yes, the sexy circus with Fleur de Lis SF. Yes, very exciting. As the Jisley is changing her pants over there, which is mesmerizing, let me tell you.
Booty, 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 booty. Rocking everywhere.
Okay. Yeah. So we're at the photo shoot for the Sexy Circus, and it's very good because there's a lot of sexy people doing a lot of weird and interesting things. But also, I wanted to talk about your act at the Sexy Circus. There's kind of like this burlesque revival going on, and it's all about the history and, I don't know, maybe the roaring what is going on with the history of burlesque?
What is going on with the history of burlesque? Well, I think a lot of people are not
like
remembering
revival.
It.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So maybe refresh us.
So yeah, there is definitely a neo-burlesque revival, and it's more based in concepts of like performance art and current sort of stripper antics and trends and all that good stuff. And yeah, there's a lot of people doing really, really amazing things all over the world. Mm-hmm. I think if you look up burlesque and Google, you know, burlesque in any city, you will find a troupe. So yeah, it's definitely happening out there.
I did an amazing interview with Dottie Lux about how burlesque can challenge the idea of female ideal beauty. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm beautiful the way I am.
No doubt. Yeah, very true.
Absolutely. And like, just because I'm shaking it in a super sassy way.
And it shakes, and it actually moves. I like that part, the jiggle factor.
Totally.
No doubt.
So let's talk a little bit about sex worker feminism, because a lot of people think that those two things can't happen at the same time. But I think a lot of the burlesque movement draws off feminism, you know, draws off female power. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, my idea, of course, about like working class women is that working class women have used sex work to elevate their class in a way that they would not have been able to do if they were mopping floors and working at the phone company and waiting tables. And I don't know, you know, modern third, fourth, fifth wave feminism. I don't understand all the terminology behind
it. Another wave. Wait, what is it?
Right. But all I'm saying is, if you can elevate yourself out of a messed up situation, why not? Mm-hmm. You know? And to me, that is what feminism is about, is changing your life for the better and reclaiming your power. Mm-hmm. And however you got to do that to get there, by all means.
How do you portray working class women in a powerful way? Like, how does that look in your dance? How does that look in your acts?
Well, I mean, what do they call it? They call it vernacular dance, right? And it's the dance of the people. And so a lot of times there are moves that are in our bodies, that are in our genetic code, that sometimes we feel a little ashamed of, like, you know, booty shaking, twerking it, you know, for example.
Super shimmy. Mm-hmm.
Right. That is a useful thing, and it turns people on. And I feel like we have to get in touch with who we were to understand who we are and our sexual power, you know? So, yeah.
Yeah, we really don't take our sexuality or our sex parts seriously. I mean, you can't, I mean, not that you necessarily would need to take yourself seriously as you're shaking your booty, but or like boobs, it's very hard to take boobs seriously. You know what I mean?
I take boobs seriously.
But they are quite serious.
Listeners, I want you to know, I take boobs very seriously.
As her red lips are sparkling, she's wearing this fabulous, very sparkly lipstick. It's amazing. It's like a disco ball.
It's my secret. Never teach the Wu-Tang style. Sorry.
She's not going to. No, we're not going to learn how to do it. But that's okay, because it looks really good on you.
Thanks.
And let's talk a little bit about in the circus. You didn't really tell us what you were doing in the hoochie tent.
Oh, I'm going to be taking my clothes off.
Is there a narrative? Or, I mean, taking your clothes off is good. I mean, I'm sure it's mesmerizing.
Yeah, no, there's, you know, I work in what they call traditional or classic burlesque, and I'm going super old school. I'm going back to the 15-minute, three-pronged structure, which is basically what they call the strut, the tease, and the strip.
Oh,
so, yeah.
Really? I didn't know there was a prong.
Oh,
or
yeah.
Three of them, really.
There's a whole stripping structure. You stick with me, sugar. I'll show you.
Oh, stop it. Oh, my God. Vagina Jenkins, how do people find you?
They can find me at www.vaginajenkins.com, on Twitter as Vagina Jenkins, or on Facebook as Vag Jenkins, because they have a problem with lady parts.
It's like those Republicans.
Yeah.
We actually were just talking about this earlier in the show, that two women Democratic speakers on the House floor were talking on the House floor about anti-choice legislation, and they were like, frankly, senators, we're flattered that you're so interested in our vagina, but we would please appreciate it if you would step off.
Mm-hmm.
And they were banned
yeah.
from speaking indefinitely.
Because vagina is a dirty word.
It shouldn't be. I mean, first of all, the only reason that it's dirty is because we have a big problem with vagina in general. I mean,
right. Exactly.
You can't even say pussy. You can't even say, you could be talking about a cat and people are like,
you know, what's funny though, is that, of course, in my 10 years stripping, I've run into a lot of folks that are like, oh my God, vagina, I can't put that on a marquee. But at the same time, they can put on a Tits McGee. A pussy galore, you know,
wow.
Like all those names are cool. But if you actually give it some power, oh no, we cannot have that.
Really?
Yeah.
Aw. I mean, it's so hard to be out of the closet and open about vagina, because, I mean, the name vagina and really that's even not the see you next Tuesday even.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's got some power.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
Oh, socialization.
America.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we'll get there. Keep shoveling. You know, keep shaking your vagina groove thing.
Will do.
Yeah,
will do.
Keep it sparkly. Thank you, Vagina Jenkins.
Thank you, Shu. Y'all have a good one. Take care.
And now, in my velvet chair of sex positivity, Mr. MC Crumb Snatcher. Welcome to Sexploration with Monica.
Hey.
Tell me about your new album.
Well, I just put out a new album on iTunes. It's called All You Faggots Can Suck My Dick.
Wow, that's quite a name. What do you mean by that, exactly?
Well, it's basically just looking at kind of the sort of aggression that's put out in the world towards gay people in general.
And sex. Like sucking my dick. That's kind of a, people use that as an insult. You can suck my dick. But really, sucking your dick should be a nice thing, right?
Exactly. Why wouldn't you want that? I prefer that.
And wouldn't we do that as friends? Can we be friends? And suck dick? What's going on?
Exactly. Exactly. I'll scratch your back. You scratch mine. I'll suck your dick. You suck mine.
Right. Interesting. So tell me more about this album. What are the other songs that you've got going on?
Well, I mean, it's all kind of in that theme. There's one that's called I Want to Get All Snuggly on Your Bullshit. There's one that's...
What does that mean? You mean that seriously? Or like snuggly on your... I'm going to have to actually get in a relationship with your vulnerable parts.
Well, I mean...
Sometimes you have to get in touch with people's bullshit because that's what their vulnerability is, right?
That's very true. I mean, it's basically just looking at... I mean, a lot of the album is actually based off of... I was listening to a Too Short album one day, and there's a line where he talks about taking some woman out to the ocean to serenade her, but he says, I'll help you manage your emotions, bitch. And I just thought it was such a ridiculous thing to be like, I love you, bitch. And I kind of went with that, and I was like, I want to snuggle with you, and then fuck the shit out of you.
Right. Well, it is nice to have both. That's certainly true. And we are always acting like we can't have both and that we don't have both. You know that there has to be such a big ocean between cuddles and really hard, aggressive loving.
And there could be both, and it can be a nice, funny thing. And that's what I really was trying to have come across in the album. A lot of it is just kind of taking that aggression and that ridiculousness of just like how, I mean, crazy it is to say something like that and turning it into a joke so that it can be something that people can take back and laugh at and kind of take back your power in that sense so that things like that are not painful.
Right, because if what you mean by faggots is gay person, there's nothing wrong with being a gay person.
Exactly.
And there's nothing wrong with sucking dick.
Exactly. It's an
offer.
So
don't say it. Like, yeah, exactly. It's an invitation. Tell me what you're going to do for the circus.
So for the circus, I'm going to be rapping. I have two background dancers. One is going to be dressed as a penguin and one is a donkey. And I'm going to be...
And you're going to be dressed as a dinosaur.
I will be dressed as a dinosaur.
So cute.
Yes, thank you. And I'm going to be doing a song called Boy, I Don't Think It's Sleazy Because We're in a Bathroom.
Of course, because I don't feel sleazy if I'm doing it in a bathroom.
It's really, I mean, it's a love song. There's a part where I offer to wipe down the seat afterwards and hold him while we're fucking against the sink.
That's sweet. You're really taking care of him.
That's true. I mean, I like to be there for people. I feel really like, I mean, I'm a top, and as a top, I'm like, if you are going to let me put my dick into your butt, then there's something that I need to offer you in exchange. Like, I need to be the one who's going to hold you and be nice to you, because that's a lot.
Well, it's interesting, because I think that we think that there's a dichotomy between stranger sex and love. Which there doesn't have to be.
That's,
you know,
very
you
true.
You could be taking care of each other, and you could have the utmost respect for each other, you know, whether or not you necessarily want to have a long-term relationship with this person.
That is very true.
You know, you have this moment, and that is a sacred thing.
I agree. You know? I have been there.
Even, and especially when it's in the bathroom. Really, there's no more sacred stuff going on than in there, really.
It's true. Well, the funny thing about that is I wrote that song as kind of like a fantasy that I had, because I wanted to do this guy in a bathroom at a club at one point, and it didn't end up happening. But then recently I ended up having a sexual encounter in the bathroom of the stud. So I feel like I manifested it by saying it into the universe.
Awesome. Let's talk a little bit about gay spaces and why gay sex is often associated with bathrooms and what's going on with that. And the culture of gayness.
Well, I mean, I feel like it was something that started because there wasn't really a place for gay people to have sex. That
right,
you had to go to.
We were saying
like
it was wrong and that you couldn't do it in a bar and there were no gay bars.
Exactly, exactly. Now it's broadened. There are more places where gay people can have sex safely, but I mean, sometimes you're just in a bathroom and you just gotta give someone a hand job or something. It's
You're like, this is the only time for us. Get over here.
Well, I mean, especially that guy. I was kind of like, oh, I don't really like you, but I've had a lot to drink and you're kind of cute. So let's do this now and I won't have to really talk to you tomorrow.
Wow. And the truth comes out. Well, okay, so let's break it down a little bit. Like, so sometimes you don't, I mean, let's look at this from a place of like, okay, sometimes you really do want to connect with someone on a level.
Yeah.
You know, and but, you know, maybe taking them home isn't the right thing for your home or for him or for you,
mm-hmm,
for whatever
mm-hmm.
plethora of reasons. Let's not get judgmental about like, oh, you must not really like each other, because you do like each other enough to do lots of sacred, neat fluid exchanging stuff.
I don't know about fluid exchanging.
Awesome way to keep it safer. Listen to that. He's not even exchanging fluids, not even spit.
Well, sometimes spit.
Okay, spit's really safe.
Yeah,
spit is
safe.
Super safer.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, yeah, good. I'm glad. And you, I don't know, what do you do for safer sex in the bathroom? Is there any tips that you can give our audience?
Well, I mean, I always keep condoms in my backpack. In that experience, it was just like some hand jobs. There wasn't really anything further than
right,
that.
Right, they're super safe. Hand jobs mm-hmm. are safer. Also, I imagine at clubs in San Francisco, they have condoms around.
That's very true.
Yeah, that's probably really helpful.
I don't understand why anyone buys condoms in this city. Like, they're everywhere.
No one does.
I hope not.
That's not true. I buy every now and then. If you don't, haven't been, you know, whatever.
And
you want something special.
I have never.
Special occasion.
I have never paid for a condom in my entire life.
Wow.
I've never had to.
We live in such a blessed nation now.
Well, even in Chicago.
The nation of San Francisco. Oh, really? In Chicago? Oh, you're
like
from Chicago. Boys Town.
Yes, Boys Town.
Let's talk about the culture there. How is it the same?
Not.
How is it different? No, you don't want to talk about it.
No, we can. I'm just kidding. I hate the culture there, however. I feel like, yes. When I was growing up, I felt really ostracized, and I really hated it. I moved to San Francisco and was just amazed at the fact that I was actually being accepted just for who I was. I went back to Chicago to visit, and it was such a healing experience for me because I was like, wow, you guys are really all assholes. Like, it wasn't me. The gay culture there is just really very... like, everyone is white, everyone has, like, a specific body type and is wearing, like, Hollister or Abercrombie or whatever, and if you don't fit that model, they don't talk to you.
Oh, well, that's not very supportive of your authenticity.
No, it's frustrating. And, I mean, I remember even before I moved here talking to some people, and one of our friends had started dating someone who was Mexican, and it was, like, this big deal. Like,
right.
they were doing something risque, and it was like, that's not risque at all.
You're not even having sex in a bathroom. Okay, that is so not risque. That is normal as daisies.
Totally. And I mean, it's like, it's liberal for the Midwest, but I think that people forget that it still is the Midwest. So there's still like this underlying racism that happens there. And it's just, I don't know, not a great place to be.
Well, it's hard because we were talking about this earlier about intersecting identities. So if you're privileged and have, you know, if you're white and you have money, you can afford to buy Abercrombie and Fitch. And you're gay, that's only one identity. That's not an intersecting identity. But then when you have another one, like maybe you're kinky or maybe you're Latino, then that's when it starts to get really difficult because no matter, I mean, in the Latino community, you're gay.
Yeah.
And in the gay community, you're Latino, so you're always an outsider.
Exactly. Or you're fetishized.
Right. You're so Latino. I bet you're spicy.
But hey,
la 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 la. Oh, and then you're like, I just want to be normal right now. Can I be normal? Is that okay?
Exactly. Exactly.
Oh, well, I want to hear more about Boys Town. I thought that was a big gay community in Chicago.
It's crappy. I mean, the whole gay scene in Chicago also kind of sucks. Like, the Pride Parade is just, like, being in hell. It's always, like, 110 degrees and humid, and it's just the streets get so packed you can't move, and there's no bathroom, so you're just, like, holding in poo, like, trying to not die.
Oh, no, not that.
The last time I went, I got stuck next to this guy who I used to date who used to hit me for, like, 2 hours because it was so crowded I couldn't move. I was like, why am I here?
Oh. That does sound like a version of hell, actually. Yeah, it does. You're next to this guy. You don't like each other. He's abusive. That's no good.
Yeah.
Oh, baby.
And the floats are all horrible. It's all like, right, grocery store, politician who doesn't really care about you.
Oh, ew. They're like, look, I'm so rainbow-rific. And you're like, oh, man.
Yeah.
Oh, like, why don't you legislate that? Okay. Well, you know, it is hard because San Francisco is so amazing and so open and so diverse and getting even more diverse, you know?
Totally. I mean, there's so many different things you can do. Last night, I actually performed a show that was just this amazing thing with, like, drag performers, interpretive dance. Like, it was this crazy menagerie. I don't even know how to describe it. It was just so much going on that was all different, but it was, like, all amazing, all totally appreciated. Like, it just felt so good to be in that environment. And I feel like that's kind of what the circus is going to be like, too. So I'm excited about that.
Oh, my God. The circus is going to be ridiculous. Okay, so Jiz Lee and Nina Hartley are going to have a scene. There's going to be an auction with James Dean. We're going to raise money for charity for the Center for Sex and Culture and for Solace SF. In addition to Vagina Jenkins doing a burlesque show and... we're going to have several dinosaur-related exciting moments. And I think it's going to be
Jurassic
a bonanza
Park
of sexy and Jurassic. And as I'm watching Vanessa Fleur put her head near... oh, who's that? Is her name Scarlett? The ballerina girl over there?
I'm so bad with
Scarlett
names.
I'm just not sure. So anyway, there's some very sexy-looking people here at the Center for Sex and Culture. And MC Crumb Snatcher, it was so fun to talk to you. How do people find your work if they want to listen to your stuff?
Well,
you're on iTunes.
I am on iTunes.
MC Crumb Snatcher.
Yes. My album's also on Spotify and Amazon. I also have a Facebook. You can just search for MC Crumb Snatcher. Same thing on Twitter. I also just discovered by accident that if you type in queer twink to a Google search and look under images, I'm
That's
in the
you.
Second row. I am the stereotypical queer twink, apparently.
Wow, what an honor. I'm sitting next to the queer twink. Awesome. What does that mean?
Well, I don't even know. I go to the Deco Lounge a lot, and the bartender there, who's a friend of mine, shaved his beard, and I was making fun of him. I was like, you're a twink like me now. And I typed it into Google just to make fun of him, and then there I was. I was like, well, this joke backfired.
Aww, that's hilarious. You're calling someone else a twink, and there you are. Damn it. Google is just the arbiter of truth and smacks you right upside the head. Aww. MC Crumb Snatcher, it's such a pleasure.
It's been lovely.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can subscribe to Sexploration with Monica on iTunes and have new episodes delivered automatically. Or download free podcasts at sexplorationwithmonica.com.